Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. My conversation today is with Russell Rickford, Assistant Professor of History at Cornell University. His book, We Are an African People, Independent Education, Black Power, and the Radical Imagination, published by Oxford University Press, is the topic of this show. Rickford offers an intellectual history of the Pan-African nationalist schools that emerged in the late 1960s from dissatisfaction with urban school desegregation and its failure to provide an equal education and foster racial pride. Influenced by third world theories and African anti-colonial campaigns, these black institutions promoted self-determination and black political sovereignty. Beginning with the campaigns for community control of schools to visions of black universities, Rickford identifies the key ideological strengths and weaknesses that ultimately resulted in the failure to build strong, independent institutions necessary for cultural renewal. The Afrocentric ideas and schools that survived were congruent with neoliberal ideology that elided the social economic conditions of African Americans. Here is my conversation with Russell Rickford. Now, let me introduce you to the author, Russell Rickford. Russell, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. But before we get into the book, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to write We Are an African People.
Okay. Let's see. My background. I did my undergrad at Howard in Washington, D.C., and then for grad school, I was at Columbia. I did a master's in African American studies, and then I went on to the history PhD at Columbia. So I've had a background in black studies, trained in history, and have been focusing on African American political culture after World War II, social movements, black transnationalism, and the black radical tradition. So this book, We Are an African People, all of those interests and fields sort of converge in this book.
Well, you paint a very sympathetic portrait of the people in your book, and there's a great deal to admire about them, their tenacity, their willingness to take amazing risks to do, you know, go do things, new things. But the story ends up being a tragedy. And that's what makes your book so poignant, I think. Is the potential was so huge of what could be done, but what happened. So we're going to go through the story, and I want to start with talking about, for you to talk to us a little bit about the failure of desegregation of the schools and how it failed African Americans, because this independent black institutions came out of this failure of desegregation to actually deliver on its promises. Can you talk a little bit about that and what happened?
Sure. Well, that's a big question. It's obviously a question that a lot of scholars and a lot of activists and other folks have spent a lot of time thinking about and talking about and writing about. I would only say, for the purposes of my story, that many, probably most of the intellectuals and educators, artists and organizers who by the late 60s and early 1970s were focusing on building independent black institutions, and particularly independent black schools and Pan-Africanist and black national schools. Most of those folks came out of earlier struggles, especially struggles around desegregation. I think it's useful to make a distinction between a struggle for integration or integrationist struggle on one hand, and a struggle for desegregation, right? Because one of the points that I make early in the book is that, you know, in the 1960s, you had highly mobilized black communities that were pushing for full citizenship, pushing for dignity, but also pushing for power. And the struggle to gain access to equal education, educational opportunity, dignified education was a big part of that. But quite often the push wasn't for integration per se. That is to say, it wasn't for an opportunity for black kids to sit next to, you know, white kids in a classroom. The push really was for decent education. As, you know, lots of scholars have pointed this this out. And it's an important distinction, because what that means is that there wasn't necessarily a political or an ideological commitment to integration per se. Desegregation, the removal of these structural barriers to a decent education, was widely seen in African American communities as a major goal. But also as part of the struggle for desegregation, more and more activists, organizers, parents, even students started to encounter some of the contradictions of the arguments, for example, that were made on behalf of integration. So, for example, the premise that a black school, a school that was predominantly or even entirely black, a public school, was necessarily inferior because of its blackness, right, which was sort of inherent or even explicit in a number of the desegregation struggles, became deeply offensive to many African Americans. And furthermore, as you suggest, there also were the, and probably more importantly, there were the practical failures of desegregation, particularly in the urban areas that I focus on, that were really affected by massive white flight, by departure from urban areas, and also to some extent from a departure from public education itself, as these central cities changed demographically and became blacker and browner, as it were, in the post-war years. And out of those frustrations, out of those failures, I think different political movements emerged. I would hasten to add, though, that I think it's a real mistake to see the movement for independent black institutions or other aspects of the black power movement simply as resulting from frustration, alienation, or disillusionment, for example, with the civil rights movement or with integrationism. One of the things I really try and stress in this book is that black power emerges from a tremendous optimism in many ways, and not simply frustration with the limitations of racial reform, but a tremendous hope and a tremendous sense of optimism that black pride, that an emphasis on black political and cultural self-determination, that a rejuvenated interest in African culture and heritage, for example, can help to complete the task of winning African-American freedom that the civil rights revolution of the 1950s and 1960s had begun. But by the late 1970s and certainly into the early by the late 60s and into the early 70s, it was very clear to many activists and organizers that new political directions, new movements were needed.
Now, one of the things that comes out of this failure of desegregation and the battle over integration and desegregation, all the and people standing in different places in this, was this idea of community control initiatives, mm-hmm. of controlling the public schools in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. What did that look like, and what did that ideology come from, and what were the features of this community control schools?
So the community control movement, I think it's a good way of getting at these questions of ideological or pragmatic commitment to desegregation. Now, community control was a grassroots demand. It was a widespread demand in many urban areas, larger cities, even smaller or medium-sized cities across the country. I mean, really, the epicenter of it was New York, particularly Harlem, and even more importantly, central Brooklyn and the Bed-Stuy or Ocean Hill, Brownsville area of Brooklyn. And in these communities in which there had been longstanding and very aggressively fought battles for desegregation, many black and brown folks, black people, Puerto Rican folks, et cetera, came to the conclusion that the only way they could get a decent education for their children was actually to control the schools, to control all aspects of the delivery and the fashioning of education. And so this became one of the most powerful movements, perhaps the most powerful movement in educational reform over the course of the 1960s. This is a movement that I chronicle in the early chapters of my book because, again, the struggle for independent black institutions and Pan-Africanist schools was another outgrowth of the community control struggle. And in community control, again, you had a range of ideologies. You had folks who ultimately were seeking integration. And then you had a great many people who were taking a much more practical or pragmatic approach. And then, of course, you had committed black nationalists and Pan-Africanists who saw an opportunity to take control of the schools in order to nurture a real commitment to black pride, black heritage, et cetera. But even these categories of black nationalists, integrationists, in many ways are porous and are not at all mutually exclusive. So I think that getting out of those sort of categories, those rigid categories, is a good way to understand the complexity of African-American educational politics.
Now, these community control initiatives failed largely because of resistance from teachers' unions, school boards. What was the nature of that resistance?
Well, I mean, so the community control struggles came up against bureaucracy. I mean, one of the you know, for example, in New York, where you had a massive and you had and have a massive public school district with a really, really entrenched bureaucracy. Part of that bureaucracy was the teachers union, you know, which had arisen, you know, ironically, as a result really of a labor struggle earlier in the, you know, 1960s, in which you had teachers struggling to gain some basic access to collective bargaining. But as a result of that, you had a teaching force that was overwhelmingly white. And when you had this struggle by parents and by community members in these, you know, black and Latino communities to gain access to the schools, that put the activists, the community activists, in direct confrontation with the, in many cases, with the interests of overwhelmingly white professionals, the teachers' union, and so that became a very combustible, you know, confrontation in many cities, in not just in New York, but in Chicago and other places. In some cases, you had you know, folks from both sides who were willing to really sit down to think creatively about how to you know, educate children that had long been neglected and marginalized. But there was also a great deal of bitterness on both sides that came out of these episodes. So, unfortunately, for example, in places like New York, you know, memories of Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and other struggles around community control really became a moment of deep racial division. And those divisions, unfortunately, have lingered for many years.
Now, there was a tension that was happening here was because of the development of black studies And what would be the nature of an education to black children in terms of the history books were very white? And is it a matter, do we look at tokenism and the black contribution to American history? What were the pedagogical differences between, you know, how you teach black children and what you teach them? This was part of the whole mix of argumentation and a lot of ill will.
Sure.
So can you talk a little bit about how black studies, the emergence of black studies, was affecting this particular battle for community control and what was going to be taught in these schools?
Sure. Well, as many fantastic scholars have argued, you know, black studies, there's been such an amazing explosion of great books on the topic of black studies. And I won't mention any of them because I know if I mention two or three, I'll miss another two or three that are equally important and fantastic. But those scholars clearly have established how important the black studies movement was and just how profoundly it changed the course of education, not just higher education, but education in general in the United States and beyond during this period. You know, those struggles over black studies, over making the curriculum more inclusive, acknowledging the history of peoples, non-white peoples, non-Western peoples, not just African Americans, for example, but indigenous Americans, etc. Those battles didn't just unfold at the college level, but they really happened at the primary school and secondary school level as well. I mean, these were really, really contentious battles. You know, for example, in New York secondary schools, high schools, there were a number of pedagogical and philosophical debates that were unfolding within those movements. One of the questions was, you know, what exactly are you educating, you know, black and brown children for? Are we educating them in order to become, you know, fully functioning members of the existing society? Are we educating, you know, black and brown children in order to politicize them, in order to so that they may go ahead and help to build a new society? You know, what is the nature of the black history? I mean, everybody agrees, and all liberals and progressives agreed that we needed more black history. But to what end, I guess, is the central question. You know, you had black, you had activists who were emphasizing black separatism. You had activists who took more of an integrationist approach, et cetera. They were also struggling both within public schools and in independent black institutions to pursue these same goals. And in fact, as we entered the 1970s, a number of black studies advocates grew somewhat disillusioned with the outcome of those struggles for black studies, because while on one hand you'd had an explosion of black studies programs and departments, many institutions of higher learning all across the country, in many ways those programs weren't fully pursuing the activist goals, the internationalist agenda, the Pan-Africanist agenda, the community-based grassroots agenda that many activists and intellectuals originally had envisioned. So independent black institutions again became, the emphasis on independent black institutions became a way that advocates of black studies could argue for a more autonomous political and pedagogical program and approach.
Some of the struggles were over what are black values? Mm-hmm. What is a black style of teaching and learning? Mm-hmm. It wasn't just about inclusion, but all kinds of other things that most people don't think about. And what was interesting about your book is I knew about black studies, of course, at the college level. I didn't realize it had reached down so far, so early. I knew it happened later, but I didn't realize it was there so early. Now, the history of movement schools, you spent your third chapter talking about some of the longer history of movement schools, including, you know, the role of the black church, Marcus Garvey, and the freedom schools that preceded these independent black schools. Can you talk a little bit about it? And what were the changes within the civil rights movement and SNCC, and the rise of black power, that sort of brought these black national schools back?
Sure. Well, so the, you know, black nationalism, Pan-Africanism are obviously very old political traditions in African-American life. They go back to the 18th and 19th centuries, obviously. In the 20th century, one of the most important and powerful black nationalist and Pan-Africanist movements of the early 20th century is the Garvey Movement, Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And, of course, a centerpiece of the UNIA's program, of Garvey's program, was the schools, independent schools. And so I spend some time discussing the Garvey schools as a kind of precursor to the black nationalists and Pan-Africanist institutions of the 60s and 70s. You also had, in the aftermath of the high point of the Garvey era, the 20s and 30s, you had the Nation of Islam schools, the universities of Islam, that proliferated in a number of urban areas across the United States. Those also served as key models in many ways for the Pan-Africanist independent schools that I focused on. And those schools continue to exist to this day, by the way. In the 1960s, so there was, you know, earlier waves of black nationalism and Pan-Africanist activity and institution building. In the 1960s, one of the most powerful models in terms of alternative education were the freedom schools, right, produced by the civil rights movement, particularly the freedom schools in places like Mississippi during Freedom Summer in 1964. And the freedom schools were basically, they were grassroots institutions. They were outside of the regular school system. And they were specifically designed by activists, by, for example, members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and other organizations to politicize children. And on one hand, to recruit for the movement, for the civil rights movement, but also to introduce broader ideas that were almost never covered in the segregated schools, white or black. Larger questions of citizenship, questions of black history, black internationalism, etc. Many of the organizers and the teachers in the freedom schools of the earlier 60s and mid 60s ended up being key organizers of Pan-Africanist and Pan-African nationalist institutions in the late 60s and early 1970s. So this is yet another way that we see a kind of continuity between, you know, what we might think of as a civil rights era and the black power era. Right. So, you know, I think my book is one of many books that see civil rights and black power as deeply interconnected, right? And I really see black power as a process of maturation, political and intellectual maturation, rather than, you know, sort of sharp departure from or decline from a heroic civil rights movement.
Now, these independent black schools were... they were in storefronts, homes, basements, and they were, the funding was almost non-existent, whatever they could raise from their own communities. And you have a couple of people that are really interesting in your book. And one was the East Palo Alto Nairobi School that was started by Gertrude Wilkes. It was a very interesting story. Can you talk about her a little bit?
Sure. Well, Ms. Wilkes, Gertrude Wilkes was... She is a fascinating figure. She's still living in East Palo Alto. She's got to be well into her 80s. She might well into her late 80s at this point. But Gertrude Wilkes was one of the most important leaders in terms of independent black institutions on the West Coast. So she was the founder of the Nairobi day school and high school, which was really a private educational complex, black educational complex in East Palo Alto, which was a small black suburb in the San Francisco Bay Area. And she was really a pioneer. I mean, many of the schools that I focus on in the book, for example, East Coast schools like the African Free School in Newark, New Jersey, or Uhuru Sasa Shule in Brooklyn, New York, those arose by the late 1960s. African Free School was very early, but Nairobi Day School actually preceded almost all of them. And Gertrude Wilkes, like many of the activists who I chronicle, began as a staunch advocate of integration, and frustrated by the limitations of integration, but also increasingly aware of the possibilities of black nationalism and self-determination, developed a kind of dual strategy where on one hand she was struggling for decent education in the public schools of East Palo Alto, and on the other hand she was also aggressively pursuing building her own school system that would emphasize, black self-determination, Pan-Africanism, etc. So Gertrude Wilkes was a key model, and the Nairobi school system was a key model for a lot of other schools.
What were these schools like? What was that school particularly like in terms of the teaching methods, the discipline, the content of the curriculum? Do you have any insight into that?
Well, they really varied. I mean, this is a moment of tremendous educational reform more broadly. This is also the moment of the counterculture. This is the moment of free schools. This is the moment of the de-schooling movement. So this is a time in which there are lots of critiques of the sort of traditional stand and deliver, teaching style in the Little Red Schoolhouse. Some of the schools that I chronicle really drew upon those alternative ideas and those educational reforms in terms of pedagogy, in terms of the question of discipline, in terms of every aspect of the educational experience. Many of the schools were more traditional or were more conservative and sort of rejected the ideas of the free school movement as basically the domain of white middle-class liberals. So it really did vary. And furthermore, the thing about my book is that my book really is an intellectual history. So it really was looking at these schools as a way of understanding ideological evolution, the change of political ideas over time, right? Because I was fascinated by the whole idea of institution building, the idea that black folks could build parallel structures, what they thought of as sort of indigenous structures in within inner cities that could serve as, almost the provisional infrastructure for a new society, a new nation, right? So the watchword at this time was not integration, it was national liberation, right? Black folks were part of a national liberation movement. So I don't spend too much time talking about, what I call the inner life of the schools in terms of governance, in terms of sort of specific pedagogy. I do spend some time, but mostly I'm interested in the formation of the schools and understanding their attempt to translate these ideologies, Pan-Africanism, black self-determination, to practice those ideologies, to translate them into action.
Now, we've mentioned Pan-Africanism many times already, and so this was not just about African Americans in the United States. Pan-African nationalism was a vision about people of African origins or heritage uniting across the globe, regardless of where they were. Can you talk a little bit about the ideology of Pan-Africanism and what parts of it that the African Americans pick up?
Sure. Well, this moment, of course, is also a time in which you've had for several years, by the late 60s and 70s, You've had the African Liberation Movement beginning in the late 50s and throughout the 60s. You see, African independence movements, liberation struggles, becoming victorious and having a tremendous political and cultural influence on Black people, not just in the United States, but throughout the West and throughout the diaspora. So that was a backdrop of the civil rights and Black power movements in the United States, the question of African liberation, the question of Caribbean liberation, and the question of third world liberation, or third worldism, as I like to call it, more broadly. That had a tremendous impact in terms of how organizers, intellectuals, and activists were thinking about the process of education and thinking about the possibilities of education. So, for example, many of the schools that I look at, including schools like the Center for Black Education in Washington, D.C., or Malcolm X Liberation University in North Carolina, ultimately Greensboro, North Carolina, were very interested in preparing students, preparing young people, not just for life within the United States, certainly not for life within corporate America, but actually preparing them, giving them the not just the ideological preparation, but the technical skills that they would need in theory to go to parts of the quote-unquote Black world, so go to, you know, young Caribbean nations, emerging African countries, and help to participate directly in the nation-building process. So participate in building infrastructure, you know, working in hospitals, et cetera. So that was very much part of the Pan-Africanist thrust, this idea that African-American struggle was part of a much larger struggle for Black self-determination all around the world. So, you know, this book is really a book about internationalism. It's a book about transcending more parochial ideas about education, about Black politics. And ultimately, it's about movement, because many of these figures went abroad. You know, for example, the Sixth Pan-African Congress in Tanzania and East Africa in 1974 was a major meeting point and turning point for many of the African-American organizers and activists who built these and ran these independent schools. So really the book is about a movement of ideas and a movement of bodies.
So what was interesting was when they went to Africa, to this Pan-African Congress, what they found was not what they thought they were going to find. They had an idea what they thought the Africa's future was going to be. And they came back, some of them pretty disillusioned about those prospects over there.
Sure, sure. So, you know, one of the central tensions in the book, I think, is what you might call a rather romantic or even utopian in some ways Black consciousness that tended to erase some of the differences between cultural differences, political differences, differences in terms of history between African-American communities and Black governments and societies on the continent of Africa and the Caribbean and elsewhere. I'm being careful as I say this because, you know, it's easy to dismiss movements as utopian in a derogatory sense. One of the things I try and celebrate in the book is the breadth and the vibrancy of the radical, you know, as we say, the radical imagination that was part of this Pan-Africanist project. By the same token, you know, a lot of folks realize once they were able to venture out into the world, once they were able to travel on the continent of Africa, once they were able to see post-colonial societies and interact in some ways at many high levels, speaking of the Sixth Pan-African Congress, interact at very high levels with government officials, that there were profound differences between African Americans, the situation and experiences of African American, and those of other African or African descended people around the world. Now, I think at best, those often jarring experiences could lead to further political maturation and political development and evolution. I think that was the best case scenario. That's not always what we saw, of course. In many cases, it could lead also to a sort of withdrawal from the international sphere and a return to more parochial outlooks. But I think that the book is not, I mean, you said early in the interview or the discussion, you used the word tragedy. And I think that certainly there are tragic aspects. But I see the book as hopeful because it tries to highlight the process of political growth, right? It really does not, it tries to avoid seeing either these institutions or the organizers who ran them as static, right? So to really be attentive to political change, to political transformation. And one of the transformations was that I saw and I tried to chronicle was a shift from a kind of narrow, what I call racial Pan-Africanism, to a much broader, what I call left Pan-Africanism, which was a Pan-Africanism that was rooted in anti-imperialism, a Pan-Africanism that didn't just support post-colonial governments because they were black, but tried to think about what liberation meant for those societies, for working people in those societies, and understood some of the problems, for example, of neocolonialism, right? So I see this as a much more promising iteration of Pan-Africanism at the time.
Yeah, because you do talk about the early schools, nationalist schools in the United States, were rather conservative in their outlook and what they were trying to, and they were very much about race, but it was very sort of conservative and even conservative in their methods of teaching and what they were teaching. And
sure.
I'm going to go back to talk about, out of this came this idea of the black university. And for you to talk a little bit about what is the difference with between a black university as the concept of a black university and the traditional African-American colleges that we know, like Howard University, for instance, or, you know, traditional black colleges. What
sure.
was it, and how did this movement of the black university influence or affect these, you know, Negro colleges that had been around for a long time? They,
sure.
How did they shape them and change them?
Sure. So my book looks at the concept of the black university. There's been some great scholarship to come out recently on this topic. Martha Biondi's book on the black studies movement also looks closely at the concept of the black university. I think the black university concept, which arose by the late 1960s, was one of the most powerful ideals of the moment, certainly in terms of the question of organizing or reorganizing education and the question of institution building. And of course, you know, what was meant by quote-unquote black university at the time was not simply HBCUs, right? Historically black colleges and universities, you know, whether we're talking about Fisk or whether we're talking about Lincoln or whether we're talking about, you know, the Atlanta schools, Howard University in Washington, D.C. In many ways, the black university concept was a critique of many of those institutions, particularly elite schools like Howard. And in fact, you know, you talk about the black studies revolt. Well, there was a major rebellion on the campus of Howard University around the question of black studies and around the question of making the institution more relevant to black people, to black folks in Washington, D.C., Northwest Washington, D.C., where Howard is situated, but making HBCUs more relevant to the black struggle and to black people in the United States and around the world. So actually, that struggle at Howard University was very generative in terms of helping to nurture and give rise to independent black institutions. So the black university concept, in short, was the idea that you could build an institution of higher learning that was not, that didn't exist in an ivory tower, that was not part of the white power structure, but that could serve in very profound and intimate ways all the social needs of rank and file black folks, working class and poor black people, particularly in urban areas, right? So it was the quest, I mean, really a very theoretical quest in many ways, to build those kind of institutions, but not just a theoretical quest, of course, because it actually produced, you know, brick and mortar experiments.
Well, you've got the Malcolm X Liberation University, which you talk about with Howard Fuller, who started that. And the whole idea, of course, was that universities couldn't just be academic centers, that they had to be engaged with the neighborhoods and this is the community around them.
Right.
And talk a little bit about Howard Fuller, because I thought he was a very interesting person.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a fascinating guy. So his name at this time was Owusu Sadaki. He took the name Owusu Sadaki. Howard Fuller was one of the most powerful intellectuals of the movement, one of the most influential, not just of the Black Independent School movement, but really of the Black Liberation movement at this time. And he was one of the key figures in the founding of African Liberation Day, which was one of the most important manifestations of Pan-Africanist politics in this period. Owusu Sadaki was the founder of Malcolm X Liberation University, originally in Durham and then ultimately in Greensboro, North Carolina. Malcolm X Liberation University, MXLU, was probably the most important, one of the most important independent black post-secondary institutions of the day. And it accepted black students from all over the place, not just the United States. It even had international students. Many of them were folks who had gone to predominantly white institutions of higher learning, some that had gone to HBCUs and had been kicked out, for example, for political activities. So there were politicized, radicalized students who were looking to participate in a truly unique experiment in black self-determination and in Pan-Africanist education. So those kind of figures flocked to MXLU in North Carolina. Owusu Sadaki then went on to be, as I mentioned, the key figure in the founding of African Liberation Day celebrations, which were really at their height in 1972 or 1973. And this was, you know, again, before I emphasize the question of political maturation. So you had, by the late 1960s, Pan-Africanism, probably one of the most powerful political tendencies within black power and seen as sort of the inevitable culmination of the black power concept. But by the early 1970s, figures like Owusu Sadaki, Howard Fuller, were really instrumental in taking Pan-Africanism to the next level. So rather than going beyond a kind of a romantic cultural nationalism, going beyond even a racial essentialism that saw, racial ties, mystical, you know, racialism as the most important connections between black folks in the United States and black folks in the diaspora and on the continent, going beyond that and thinking very concretely about how the oppression of African Americans economically, politically, culturally is linked to the ongoing oppression of black people, working people around the world. And African Liberation Day, which raised funds and support for ongoing liberation struggles on the African continent, particularly Southern Africa and the Portuguese colonies, was the sort of outcome of that shift to a far more, what I would define as a far more politically promising version of Pan-Africanism.
Now, the institutions, the black institutions, these independent schools, they faced several challenges that really sort of became their decline. One was the disillusionment with Pan-Africanism, the feud between the right-leaning nationalists and black Marxists, repression from the federal investigations, and funding challenges, you know, being cut off from funding when I think at one point the Episcopal Church was giving money to one of these institutions and then they, you know, took it away. And there was also the ideological erosion into self-help in the age of Reagan. And so you still have these African-centric schools, but now it's more bourgeois sort of nationalism, much more conservative, much more it has in line with white conservatives who also want control over the education of their children.
Sure. So, right. So, which is one of the perhaps less upbeat, you know, aspects towards the end of the book. I'm tracing what I see is a shift from a deeply politically engaged Pan-Africanism, from Pan-Africanism whose centerpiece was, for example, African Liberation Day, and raising funds for, you know, ongoing support of liberation movements. That is to say, a deeply politically engaged and internationalist Pan-Africanism, and a Pan-Africanism that was tied not just to black nations or black governments, but also was deeply engaged with the third world. And was thinking about questions of third world, you know, Marxism in places like Cuba, for example, or Vietnam. I traced the decline of that kind of Pan-Africanism and the rise of something that was in some ways similar in terms of its emphasis on black self-determination, but in a much more politically limited and limiting sense. And I call that movement Afrocentrism. Now, Afrocentrism, I argue, took a much more bourgeois approach. It took an approach that was much more parochial. It wasn't engaged to the same extent with liberation movements around the world. Didn't have that kind of a incisive internationalist outlook. And that was much more conciliatory towards capitalism and towards other conservative forces that were coming to the, you know, to the fore in the 1970s and 1980s. So ironically, Afrocentrism became very successful in many ways by the late 20th century. There were, for example, many, many Afrocentric schools, both within and outside of public education systems in many major cities. But I argue that these schools, by and large, I mean, there were some sort of counterexamples that I cite. But by and large, these schools weren't committed to the kind of open-ended, radical political project that many of the independent black institutions at the height of the late 1960s, 1970s were.
This is why I said that your story was a tragedy, because there was so much momentum and possibilities and just an imagination that was just, some people call it maybe utopian, but I agree with you. Utopianism can be used as a way to say something is, you know, not very smart or not realistic or pragmatic. Sure. But I think it was pretty powerful, and it seemed like all these reversals, not only internal conflicts, but also external pressures.
Sure.
It caved in. It ended up with what you end up in the end. So that's why I think that's the tragedy of it, that there was the potential was tremendous.
Sure. Well, you know, this is a question. This is a philosophical question in terms of how we read and I guess how we write history and for what purpose, to what end, right? I think it's really important to study all of those factors that you mentioned, the internal collapse, the external pressures, to understand the repression, to understand COINTELPRO, to understand the internal feuds, you know, what was called the two-line struggle, as you mentioned, the long-running and deeply destructive conflict between black Marxists on one hand and more conservative black nationalists on the other. But again, I tried to highlight, I think, throughout the book and even towards the end, where there's a lot of bad news, right, about some of the conservatism of Afrocentrism, I tried to highlight the promise of these ideas and the fact that they never really die, right? They're always there. Quite often they seem dormant. But the ideas of Black self-determination, Black internationalism, some of the anti-capitalist ideas, some of the third worldism, these movements leave behind embers that can reignite, you know, is how I like to put it. And I see in some ways that we see, you know, movements like Black Lives Matter, that include some elements of this question of independent institutions. We've seen, you know, not just in Black Lives Matter, but more broadly across the country, we've seen a resurgence of emphasis on independent institutions, building, you know, urban gardens, you know, alternative economies, alternative institutions. So I think that these ideas, you know, they keep their currency. And even though the immediate movements may be defeated or may collapse, there's tremendous promise for alternative approaches and for movement building in the future. And so I hope that this book, like I hope all my scholarship is, serves as a model, sometimes a cautionary model, but also helps to inspire future struggles.
No, I think they're very inspiring. The stories are very inspiring about what it is that these people were, these ideas, and could we use these ideas again? Okay, could mm-hmm. we use these ideas to deal with some of the incredible problems that we're having right now? This idea of independent institutions that are close to the people, right, instead of far away in bureaucratic systems.
Sure.
I get you there. So anyway, that you have been, you've given me a lot of your time, so I just want to ask you one more question.
Sure.
What are you working on now?
Well, you know, so I'm working on a book about Guyana. Guyana is a country in South America. It's actually my native land. I was born in Guyana in the 70s and grew up, you know, my family moved to the U.S. I grew up in Northern California beginning in the 1980s. But I was drawn to Guyana for a number of reasons. So this moment in the 1970s, I'm fascinated by. And during this time, Guyana became, for some African-American leftists, progressives, and Pan-Africanists, became a very important site politically and culturally, a site of tremendous promise. And there was even a small trickle of migration to Guyana. It's in South America. It's a former British colony. It was very much part of the, you know, culturally, it's part of the, and politically, part of the Caribbean. So I'm doing a book about the sort of place of Guyana in the radical African-American imagination of the 1970s. And it's looking at, you know, folks who actually went to Guyana, so Black African-American expatriation in Guyana. But more broadly, I'm thinking about the idea of how Guyana was being imagined, how it was being conceived as a political destination, as a place that was providing sanctuary, for example, for African-American, you know, political prisoners. So this is, you know, a confrontation of questions of, again, of exile, of expatriation, but also some of the ideas of nation building and internationalism that I touch upon in this current book, We Are an African People. So I think it's a project that's linked in many intimate ways, but it's also quite new because I'm sort of trying to refashion myself as a Caribbeanist. So there was a huge stack of, I've got about 100 books stacked up in my office that I have to read. I got to teach this semester too. I don't know how I'm going to get it done, but I'm going to, by the end of it, I will have refashioned myself, as I say, as a Caribbeanist. I'm looking forward to the project.
Okay. Thank you, Russell.
Thank you so much, Liam. This has been fun.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. You can reach me through my website, www.lillianbarger.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.